broadcasting before and probably after the rapture. It's the Drew Marshall Show.
Out that the closer I get to 50, the worse I sing.
Hold on a minute. The closer you get to 50?
Yeah, I'm not 50 yet.
But you look well past 50.
Shut up.
No, you don't.
Thank you. I'm growing out my beard. You know why I'm growing my beard?
Because you can't grow anything upstairs.
Really?
Sorry. Oh, yeah, I'm that way, too. Never mind.
That's John, would you pay attention? Stop looking at it. He's Googling his own book.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I'm looking at Thin Lizzy.
Oh, yeah.
Who I saw four times.
Phil Lynott.
And I just passed a statue in Dublin and paid my respects the other day.
Did you?
Yeah. Incredible.
Where was I? I was talking about me, wasn't
Your
I?
Your beard. Why am I growing my beard?
I'm growing my beard because I'm...
He's buying an El Camino.
Because October, November, I'm going to do the Camino Trail.
Do you know what? I was meant to do it leaving next week.
Are you kidding?
I know. Sorry. I couldn't do it. Do you know why I couldn't do it? For all those parents of teenagers out there, and Jake, you're listening right now, so I'm still mad. I said to our son, let's go to Rome. Let's go to Rome.
Yeah.
And go see the gladiators, whatever. And Jake goes, nah, I just want to stay home for March break. And I was going to leave right from Rome and go do the Camino. Instead, I'm stuck with you in the studio.
Hey, come on now. I'm kind of like the Camino Trail. I'm a spiritual adventure.
You're really going to do it.
Yeah, I'm doing it. But I'm doing it slow-mo, and I'm doing it as a silent retreat.
That's impossible for you.
The first week, I'm literally going to have duct tape on my mouth.
No, but I'm going to have to help you. The Camino Trail is about community, so that's part of it.
I'll be communicating with people, but I will be... It's actually an experiment we're going to turn into a book.
Tim, we're going to come along.
Yeah, he's going to use sign language. Unfortunately, he just knows one word.
Yeah, Mr. Bean says hello when he goes to L.A.
Hello.
All right, listen, you're listening to the Drew Marshall Show. We're in the studio here with John McCauley, a Belfast boy, Tim the Tool from the clinic, and our next guest, he's an Irish poet, he's a theologian, he's a leader at the Corrymeela community, and we've all been having fun trying to pronounce his name because it is the weirdest looking written name I've ever seen in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick Otuma. Did I say that right?
Podrick?
Oh, come on. How do you say your name?
Podrick Otuma.
Podrick Otuma. Podrick.
Yeah.
So it's
basically
Patrick, though, isn't it?
Well, Patrick is basically it, if you want to look at it a different way.
Oh. Wow. Listen.
Irish is a pretty old language, yeah.
Yeah. And I would like to introduce you to another man from your country. Sitting beside me is John McCauley. John, this is...
Hi, John.
Patrick.
Hi, Patrick.
No,
hi,
you
John.
Called him Patrick. You can't
I
say
I said Patrick, if you listen to the inflection.
Isn't it Podrick?
Patrick.
It is Podrick, yeah.
I said it right.
Yeah.
Do you need me to do some perfect resolution?
Actually, we between him and me, yes, you do.
Yes, I know. Yeah, that was a me being subtle.
This is like a whole Abbott and Costello routine. This is ridiculous. All right, let's talk about this place, Corrymeela. Corrymeela, did I say that right?
Yeah, Corrymeela. Corrymeela is a peace and reconciliation community that started in 1965. Just before the Troubles broke out, actually, but really in response to tensions in Northern Ireland, and set itself up as a place of faith and prayer and pilgrimage and politics and dialogue for people who were coming away to have really serious arguments about what was happening in society. As you know, Northern Ireland was kind of created after, in 1921, when the island of Ireland was partitioned as the British were leaving. And so some people love the border and the creation of that, of the statelet of Northern Ireland. Other people hate that border and the division of a country. So there was never a real peace, but it broke out into conflict then in 68, 69. So,
okay,
Corrymeela, for 50 years, has been a place of people coming together to talk and to argue, but to try to argue well. Without getting violent.
Who argues better, the Jews or the Irish? Because I love that, like the Jews that I hang out with down in L.A., they have fantastic discussions. They love wrestling with things, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I learned to argue from Irish Jews, so
Well, that'll work. That'll work right there. So, John, have you been to this Corrymeela place?
I've never been, but anybody that grew up in Northern Ireland knows about it, because at the height of the Troubles, there was always another narrative that was coming out of the Corrymeela Centre. So, Patrick, I'm a huge fan, and know that the work that you guys have done over the years have probably saved as many lives as were taken.
Wow. Yeah, well, we hope so. Yeah, there's a lot of, there's lots of organizations of goodwill and peace and dialogue, and we're really honored to be one amongst those. We have around 10,000 people a year come through our programs, so it's a really important piece of work. Always exhausting, always demanding, never done, but always fulfilling as well.
So, what do you actually do there?
So we have around 40 staff. We work with
them. No, well, what do you do? What's your job? What's your role?
I'm the leader.
I'm the leader.
I'm the leader. Yeah, there's two people in leadership roles, executive director and leader. And so I look at some matters to do with funding. I do a lot of writing. I start off particularly, I have responsibility for our theological and faith-based programs. I'm a poet, so I also have some involvement in some of our arts-based work. I was with Corrymeela for about 8 years as poet in residence before I became leader. So, yeah, there's a lot of involvement in the arts that incorporate.
Did you say poet in residence? Poet in residence.
I did say poet in residence,
yeah.
Do you
get paid for that?
Not very well.
No. I got to get me a gig like that.
It was voluntary.
You know, we had a poet on our show last year, Malcolm Guite. Do you know? I think you guys.
Oh, I know Malcolm Guite. Of course, I do. We're published by the same people, actually.
Right. I found him to be quite interesting to listen to. How about you? Yeah. Are you interesting to listen to? Like, are we able to get a little poetry thing happening from you? Do you have a little something that you can just kind of share with us right now?
For
example, if I was to start doing something here, just off the, like freestyling, right? I would start with something like this. It would go, in West Philadelphia, born and raised, on the school ground was where I spend most of my days. You don't even get that show over there, do you? Do you get Fresh Prince of Bel-Air?
Oh, I remember it, yes.
And we're trying to forget it.
That went south real quick. All right. Well,
let's go into the Troubles. Too much poetry as a youngster rather than watching the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Did you get beat up a lot in schools because you were reading poetry instead of watching TV?
Yeah, yeah. I also did gymnastics, yeah. So it wasn't a happy school experience.
I did gymnastics, too.
You, too.
I was the fifth in all Ireland in gymnastics, floor and vault. So
were
there you are. Yes,
oh,
sir.
Can we just move on?
But it was out of four contestants. That's the thing.
Do you know a guy named Brian Houston, singer-songwriter?
Yeah.
Went to school with Brian.
You went to school with Brian?
I played in a band with Brian. I was his drummer.
I'm trying to get our guest to be more important than you are right now, John.
I'm segueing.
Patrick.
John, you probably sang with my friend Caroline Orr then. She used to do backing vocals for Brian Houston.
Well, I know, I don't know her personally, but I've heard of her. But I left before Brian made it big. He kicked me out of the band.
Oh, okay.
That's the same story you tell about you too.
Let's get back to this man.
This man's
a legend.
All right, let's do some poetry. Drop something on us. What are you going to do?
So there's a short poem called Not Yet. I was at a meeting once when there was a young person who spoke about the Troubles. The Troubles is the word we use to talk about the 30 years of conflict. And so this young man in his 20s made reference to the Troubles. And somebody in the room said, you're too young to know about the Troubles. And then the young man said the following. And so I'm just turning to it here. I've got to talk until I get to it.
We do that a lot here.
Yeah, well, that's, you just described our entire show.
I picked that up, yeah. The poem is called Not Yet. You're too young to know about the Troubles, the peace man said. And the young man said, father dead, mother fell apart, brother fell into himself, other brother sent to live with others, and me, I smothered everything. I was farmed around, and now, years later, we have found ourselves back beneath a shared and troubled ceiling. Not yet. No one's too young to know about the Troubles.
That's pretty heavy, man.
Wow.
That's heavy.
Well, okay, it's heavy, but it's also true. And sometimes the truth is heavy, isn't it, when you're talking about what people have survived.
All right. When it comes to the Troubles, we've got to talk about, you know, for the outsiders who don't know anything about it, oh, that's the Irish when they fought amongst themselves, right? Yeah, that's maybe the generic way they, oh, that's between the Protestants and the Catholics. That's what it, I mean, sure. Is that how you sum it up? Not really, right? So, because I think most people will say, oh, this whole thing is about religion. There you go. There's religion again, screwing up the world. Patrick, what do you say about that?
Well, really, it's about territory, and it's about whether the partition part of Ireland, Northern Ireland, is British or Irish. And the tendency was that those who thought it was British tended to be Protestant, those who think it's Irish tend to be Catholic. And so it really is about land, it's also about money, it's about economics, it's about language, it is also about religion. So there's lots of overlapping factors, but really it's about who has sovereignty over what place. Is partition valid? It's about the legacy of colonization, and it's about what happens when people try to change the narrative of a country or a region and then try to find what it means to live with each other or not. So, I mean, no war can be summed up in the Twitter headline. So, I mean, I don't try to find easy descriptions of a war that lasted 30 years and 3,500 people were murdered. So if people want a simple answer, you just think, well, that's a simplistic question. No war can be answered simplistically.
It's the great line.
Engage with subtlety.
Patrick, the great line from that movie with Brad Pitt where he said, if you could explain it, you don't understand what's going on.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, for sure. I mean, yes. I mean, it's the same with any country, though. I mean, I know within Canada, depending as to who you ask, there's different stories about what Canada means for people. Indigenous people in Canada will start at a different place than somebody whose family might have arrived 70 years ago. So,
John, your experience with that whole scene was what, as a young lad?
I mean, I grew up right in Castlereagh, but our church was down at the Short Strand, Woodstock area. I don't know if you heard me say that earlier. So, but I grew up very much on one side of the fence, but I had parents that chose not to live that way. My dad worked for the Smurf Group out of Dublin, and one of my mom's best friends was Catholic, although she'd married into the Protestant family. So I grew up with this kind of a different model of how you could live together. And then, of course, at 18, I made the wise and intelligent decision to join the Royal Ulster Constabulary ended up getting posted on the borders in Bessbrook and places like that, which was, my mother didn't sleep for 3 weeks. I didn't sleep for 14 months. But, I got to see all of it. But I had an uncle who had this love for all of Ireland, and he redefined for our family how you could live, how you could be together, and we vacationed in the south. I only know one other family out of all my friends that ever vacationed in the south of Ireland. So I grew up in this really in-between family, in-between place. Our family's divided. My grandmother's family were divided, Catholic, Protestant. So some of our family grew up in Andersonstown. They joined the IRA. Those of us on this side, we joined the British Army and the police. So the funerals were usually really entertaining places.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, sure. Tense. Yeah.
So, Patrick, your hope, I mean, you've got to be a hope junkie doing what you do. So what's your hope?
Yeah, of course. Well, my hope is that the small narratives that are happening everywhere in the north of Ireland of people coming together to overcome their differences and to find a way to live well with their differences, that those small narratives and acts of courage that really are happening on every corner can be translated into policy and politics, and that leaders can continue also to demonstrate the kind of courage that it takes to make gestures towards each other. There have been some extraordinary gestures of leadership over the last 20 years, really, since the peace accords started to happen. And so the hope is really that continues. And also that Ireland, as a place that has a troubled relationship with border and with history and with jurisdiction, that is unfortunately a story that's very live and appropriate for other zones of conflict around the world. So I think Ireland has this message
when it comes to
leadership to share.
When it comes to peace, when it comes to this whole thing that you do, which is a horrible way to describe it, but the word pacifism comes into play as far as my brain is concerned, and then I think about what difference are you really making? And the only time I've really seen sort of extreme pacifism work is in Gandhi's case. We had Gandhi's grandson on our show a few weeks ago, and of course we talked a lot about what went down at that point in time. But what we're talking about here is basically an innocent person willing to be beat for the sake of a greater goal, a greater vision, a greater victory. And until innocence gets beaten and the world sees it and takes notice of it, will there really be a difference? Because otherwise, it's still driven by agenda. And until it's a pure agendaless thing, and I think that innocence is agendaless. Your take on what I'm blathering on about?
I'm hearing what you're saying. I suppose one of the complications about our conflict here in Ireland is that each side thinks that they're innocent. That's often the situation. And so that it's not like everybody goes, well, you're the innocent one, but we're going to continue to be the aggressor. Each side would recognize that they are more innocent than the other. There's an amazing sociologist who's a friend of mine, Claire Mitchell, and she says that Northern Ireland is a meta-conflict because there's conflict about what the conflict's about. And I think that's a really helpful way to understand the complexity of conflict and the fact that any intervention has to work on so many different levels, from the ground, from the parish, up to the level of policy and politics. And that's where I do think we need extraordinary levels of courage to move towards each other.
We had Hamza Yusuf on the show, who's an Islamic scholar, and he was on a few weeks ago. You're aware of him, are you?
I'm familiar with his name, and I've read tiny bits.
Yeah, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf. And he basically said, until we march women and children into areas that our people should not go, and they're slaughtered. Until that happens, there will be no real change in the Middle East.
Yeah, I wouldn't say the same kind of thing. I want to hear more about his context as to know what he's trying to say.
Because that's what I'm talking about when it comes to innocence. I don't mean like which side thinks they're right or innocent or whatever. I mean innocence. I mean like women and children. I mean, like people being beat for no reason and not retaliating. I mean, that was the resistance that Gandhi had. That was the impact of that, right? Tim, I mean, you're
a big
fan of this guy.
I was just looking something up. I just heard a broadcast on CBC. A French philosopher, Gerard, I think his name is, did this whole series about the scapegoat. Certainly. And the innocent changing things.
Yes.
Fascinating, but absolutely this is exactly what
we're
talking
about. Corey Miller is built on a Girardian model of understanding the world. And so we do have this understanding that societies continue to look for a scapegoat and then seek to slaughter that scapegoat. The scapegoat can be innocent, or the scapegoat can also be perhaps partly guilty. But still, the slaughter of a scapegoat isn't the thing that will ever help. It's usually the thing that we use to distract ourselves. So we say, well, this group of extremists or that group of extremists, and when we have them out of our society will be pure, instead of recognizing that each society has violence at its heart, and we need to attend to the ways within which each community is regularly manifesting violence towards those within its own ranks. But often our capacity to do that is distracted by the ways in which we speak about the other. So we create these wars which are really trying to dampen the violence in our own hearts.
You know, when I think about it, we've got to finish that. We're running out of time here, mate. But I have spent 30 plus years pathetically trying to follow behind a scapegoat, pathetically trying to surrender to a scapegoat. I find it easier to fall in love with a scapegoat than a hero.
Yeah. Yes, well, the scapegoat is an extraordinarily powerful narrative. I do understand the gospel within the context of the final story of scapegoat, and recognizing that scapegoating is a hollow process, and that the crucifixion is one of the things that shows the hollowness of human violence.
Yep. Yep, well said, well said. Well, what a privilege to have you on our show today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Happy St. Patrick's Day next. I don't know, do you guys say that in Ireland? Or
well, it depends whether you're from the north or south.
Banachtí lá na féile Pádraig.
Whoa, say that again,
Banachtí lá na féile Pádraig. Blessings of the festival of Patrick, that's what we'd say.
Oh, I like that.
Gaelic.
Say more Gaelic. Hey, hold on, are you married or are you single?
I'm not single, but I'm not married.
Wow, you see what he did there?
I have a partner.
Okay, wow. So when you first wanted to express your feelings to your partner, give us something mushy in Gaelic, you may say.
Yeah, actually, love isn't a verb in Irish, so you can't say I love you. So one of the things you can say is Machiolhu, which means you are my music.
Or you just spit all over them saying that.
McMule.
You're my mule. I like it.
Machiolhu.
Okay, beautiful. Listen, Padraig, thank you so much again for joining us again. Padraig O'Toole is an extraordinary. Hold on, I have to read this for you. He's an extraordinary person whose influence extends quietly and gracefully across this world. His poetry bears these same qualities and brings him close. It is a gift to us all. Krista Tippett, who has been a guest on our show, creator and host of On Being,
That's an extraordinary person.
She said that about you.
Inspiration.
Here's the best endorsement. You're publishing a book of poetry? Oh, that's nice, I suppose. Did you hear the woman down the road died? It was a lovely funeral, packed out. Patrick's ma said that.
My mother, yeah. My mother keeps me down to earth.
Yeah.
Like all of ours.
Patrick, fill your boots.
Thanks very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I just thought I'd try to be cool and Irish there. Fill your boots. What does that mean, anyway?
I've never heard that
saying.
Shut up,
you have
to. Never once.
Fill your boots.
I love how you looked at him like, there you go. There's something Irish. He's looking at you like, I have never heard that in my life. Never.
It's like fill your boots.
You don't drink Foster's in Australia either, really. It's like,
yeah, they hate it.
No,
down there.
They can't stand it.
Foster's Lager.
La-di-da, la-di-da, la-di-da.